Okay, this is Ken Samuelson. Today's date is March 24th, 2000. My home address is 545 Southwood Drive in Eden, North Carolina. My telephone number is 336-623-7787. And I'm here with Mr. George Ziegler, Navy veteran of World War II. And George, if you would identify yourself with your full name and where you live and your telephone number, this kind of thing.
My name is George E. Ziegler, Jr. I live at 315 Wilson Street, Eden, North Carolina. My phone number is 336-627-7390.
Okay, and how long have you lived here, George?
I've lived here since 1964.
Okay. Well, let's go back to where you were born then and the date of, did you give your date of birth?
I was born in Thomasville, Georgia, August 2nd, 1918.
Okay.
I grew up in Thomasville and went to school there through the 8th grade. And then my family moved to Columbus, Georgia in 1932. That was during the Depression, and my father went where his job took him. I finished high school in Columbus, Georgia in 1935. And then went to North Georgia College at Dahlonega, Georgia for 2 years. In the meantime, my family had returned to Thomasville, Georgia. When I graduated from North Georgia College, I had an appointment to the Naval Academy, but that was the first year that they had put in the refractive examination on eyes, and that kept me out. I spent two unhappy days up there, two hot days, but had to return home very disappointed and start my life over. Then I went to Georgia Tech for 4 years, finished in 1941 with a degree in mechanical engineering.
George, when you finished in, when did you finish in 41? What part of 41?
In June 9th, 1941.
June of 41. At the time you finished your university training then, What was your understanding of what was going on in the world at that time? Did you have any, feel like you were well informed of what was going on, or was there just something in a faraway place happening?
I think I was pretty well informed. It was my feeling, and the feeling I think of most people, that we were going to get involved in the war, which had been going on in Europe almost 2 years. And the Japanese were acting up, and that was a difficult situation. We were shipping them scrap iron, which we knew they would be sending back to us by other means. So during my senior year, I had taken a job at DuPont in Waynesboro, Virginia, a very good job. But then the Navy and the Air Corps started looking for engineers. The Navy made a very attractive offer, so I had to write DuPont and ask them to relieve me, and they said the draft would not be a problem. They could handle that, but that was not a problem with me either. I had registered for the draft in October 1940 when the first draft took place, and I had a fairly high draft number, so I was not concerned. So DuPont released me, and I accepted a commission in the Navy subject to graduation, and was ordered to active duty July 1st, 1941, just 3 weeks after finishing school.
What was your process when you elected to join the Navy? Who did you write? Who contacted you? How did that work?
Dean George Griffin, who was head of the placement department at Georgia Tech, was also a Naval Reserve officer. In fact, he had commanded the PC in World War I, and then went back to Georgia Tech and finished, and among other highlights, he played on the Georgia Tech football team that beat Cumberland 222-0. That goes down in history as a big event. But George Griffin was my advisor on this, and he thought it would be a good thing to do, and I agreed. Never been disappointed.
So did you write then, or did somebody contact
you? The Naval Reserve ROTC had a unit at Georgia Tech, so I had firsthand contact with them.
I see. So you had first, so you knew what you were doing then, and had pretty well informed about what you might be getting into then. Okay, so you elected then to join the Navy, and then where did that carry you? And you, where did you actually? Where were you sworn in, and so forth?
My first duty was at Georgia Tech, where about 100 engineers from all over the country came there for a two-month indoctrination school, where they were teaching us what the Navy was all about, customs of the service, gave us some marksmanship training. We did a lot of drilling, and we got measured for our uniforms, which were all tailor-made. So by the time we finished that two-month period, we felt we were ready to go. One interesting sidelight, these people came from all over the country. We had one man from Idaho who had never even seen the ocean, yet he was a naval officer.
Did they, back in those days, give you, now you had a big investment in your uniforms and all the rest, did they give you a clothing allowance back then?
We had a clothing allowance, and as I recall, that took care of a bigger part of it.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you were at Georgia Tech then for a period of time, and then what was your first move after that then?
Well, at Georgia Tech, the roughly 100 people were divided into three groups, and we don't know how this was ever done, but one group, the one which I was in, was ordered from there to various Navy yards for indoctrination and ship construction. Another group was sent up to Penn State to study diesel engines. At that time, the Navy, of course, had an awful lot of ships with diesel-powered landing craft and so forth. The third group was sent up to Bowdoin College in Maine to study electronics. And they didn't know what they were studying, but it was radar. At that time, if you knew anything about radar, you didn't even repeat the word. It was so top secret.
Mm-hmm.
That group wound up with some very interesting experiences.
And which group were you in again?
I was in the group that was sent into ship construction, and I was ordered to Norfolk Navy Yard along with five other men out of the group.
Of course, this is prior to Pearl Harbor now we're talking.
Yes, this was September 41.
September 41, okay. So you were ordered then to the Norfolk, you say Norfolk Naval Base?
Yeah, Norfolk Navy Yard.
Norfolk Navy Yard, right. Okay, and so what was your duties there? How were you received there as a young ensign, I assume?
Yes, there were a whole group of us, and a former school teacher had been commissioned. He was a lieutenant. To sort of take us under his arm and train us in Navy Yard operations. And we were assigned to various activities and had to write reports on all our work, so we were well supervised. The first month was I spent time going around all the shops and the dry docks and piers and shipboard work in what might be termed as a shipyard orientation. In the second month, which was October, I was assigned to new construction duty. At that time, the USS Alabama was on the ways, pretty well along the way. The destroyer, USS Herndon, was fairly well completed, and the minesweeper, USS Auk, had just been completed and was just been launched and was being completed at a dock in the yard. My interest was in the Alabama, and I had occasion to, we had all kinds of freedom. I had occasion to climb all over the Alabama, and I could see all the details of construction, which at that time were quite interest to me because that was to be my life for a while.
Okay, because this is late 41 now. What was the atmosphere like at that shipyard? Was it, could you feel the tension of things building into something really about to pop, or was it still pretty routine, I guess you'd say?
Norfolk Navy Yard was on a wartime basis even then.
Okay.
The HMS Illustrious, the British carrier that the German Stukas had worked over going into Malta. He'd come in there in May of 41 after 2 weeks of temporary repairs at Malta, and was still there when in the fall of 41. Later, two other British carriers of the same class came in for various work. And I had occasion to go aboard all of these ships and docked several of them. Incidentally, during the month of October, or rather November, I was on dry docking duty, which involved getting up about 2 o'clock in the morning to be at the yard about 4 o'clock to check the dry dock before it was flooded and take care of bringing the ship in on the high tide around 6 in the morning. And during that time, I had some very interesting experiences, including docking the USS Hornet, which was a brand new carrier at that time, the Illustrious, which was a British carrier, the Indomitable, which was a British carrier, the Formidable, which was another British carrier, the USS Williamsburg, which later became President Truman's yacht, the USS Potomac and USS Calypso, which were President Roosevelt's yacht and service vessel, and the Sequoia, which later became Roosevelt's yacht. Those were docked while I was on duty.
And why were they docked there? For repair?
For various underwater work.
Okay. So they were just out of commission temporarily while you repaired them, and then they went back to...
They were still in commission, but they're out of operating.
Yeah, out of operating condition, I guess, huh? Okay, so this is late 41 now, and of course you see firsthand what's happened overseas with these carriers coming in. Were they pretty pretty badly damaged, most of them, or that came in? Is that the reason they came in, for repairs, or was it more mechanical?
The Illustrious was the only one badly damaged. The others were in for fairly routine repairs. Uh-huh. And the Illustrious had a 3-inch armored flight deck, mm-hmm. which the British used in their construction, and the Germans had put tail fins on armor-piercing shells, and they went right through that flight deck.
Oh. George, at this time, again, did you feel any tension about anything building that you, or any information passed down from...
No, I had occasion to talk to Lieutenant Miller, who had come in from Pearl Harbor, and he assured us that everything was under control out there. Uh-huh. This must have been about October.
Uh-huh.
And he lived at the place where I was living temporarily. Uh-huh. And he said the Army, the Air Corps, had patrols 100 miles out all around the Hawaiian Islands, and the Navy had patrols 500 miles out. But we know now what happened.
Yeah. Okay, then let's get over to about December 7th then. Were you on any sort of extra special alert up there at your group with your Navy Yard people and your activities up there?
No. Conditions, as I say, we were pretty much on a wartime basis.
Uh-huh.
December 7th was on a Sunday, and some friends and I had gone to a movie over in Norfolk, and when we came out, we stopped in the men's room, and the sailor in there was using all kind of language describing the Japanese, and it wasn't very flattering, and he said they'd bombed Pearl Harbor. Well, we figured he'd sober up and get over all of that, but when we got out in the street, it was obvious something was happening. We got in the car, and on the radio, all ships were, all military personnel were ordered back to their stations. And all leave was canceled, and
so this
was evident that what had happened.
So this was on Sunday. You had seen the movie, and you heard this over the radio.
Right.
So what did you do?
Well, we went home and got in uniform. At that time, we wore civilian clothes, except on duty.
Mm-hmm.
Went home, got in uniform, went to the Navy Yard, but obviously nothing we could do. So we went back home, and the next morning, we reported for duty, and the Navy was at war.
Did you get any other kind of information when you went to the Navy Yard on Sunday other than what you'd already heard over the radio?
No. People at the Navy Yard, if they knew anything, of course, our fleet was very badly damaged, and that was not going to be publicized.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we could learn nothing except that we were in trouble.
So on Monday then you got, I guess, a fairly full story of what happened.
Yes. One interesting sidelight, on that Saturday I had written orders to accompany the USS Santee, which was a Navy oiler that I'd been working on as assistant ship superintendent, had orders to accompany it to sea on a sea trial on December 10th. Well, we figured they'd probably change that, but they didn't. So we stood out from Norfolk for 3 or 4 hours straight out to sea at full power, testing the engines. We had a bunch of shipyard workmen on board. We were installing magazines and getting ready to install additional guns, and came back in, and of course a little time later submarines were looking for tankers off of Norfolk, but we were fortunate.
Mm-hmm. Were you on an alert status when you went out there? Had you been warned that, hey, there may be...
I have no idea. I was just an observer of, yeah, of the shipyard work being done.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that they would not have gone out there. They could have made the same trial at Chesapeake Bay if there had been any real
danger.
Danger.
Yeah.
One interesting sidelight there, as we were standing out to sea, we met a freighter coming in, and I noticed a man running up, and he ran up and dipped the colors. Of course, the Santee was flying a commissioned pennant, and merchant vessels have to dip the colors to naval vessels.
Oh, okay. So was that something unusual?
That impressed me because, gee, we're a naval vessel, we're not a tanker.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right. Okay. Okay, so... So what was the atmosphere like when you went back to work on Monday then? Did you notice any additional, security, for example, or anything of that nature, or any?
No, the security is pretty high already. As I say, the Navy yard, in effect, was at war.
Uh-huh.
And later, I don't recall the exact timing, we had the Hornet, which had been in earlier, come back in, and the Yorktown, which had been in the North Atlantic, and three battleships, the Idaho, Mississippi, New Mexico came in with six destroyers, one of which was the USS Russell, which I worked on.
Mm-hmm.
And these ships were headed for the Pacific because we had no fleet out there at that time.
Right.
And they came in for various work, but primarily to install anti-aircraft guns.
Mm-hmm.
I recall that on the Russell we installed six 20 millimeter mounts, four forward and two aft, with a ready service ammunition, magazine storage, and we had to provide facilities for 35 additional men.
Mm-hmm.
But we also took off the torpedo tubes. That was a weapon we didn't need in the Pacific at that time. And I heard that the Navy was having to scrape the East Coast to get these guns together. The Yorktown and the Hornet each had 20 millimeter guns installed, mm-hmm, 10 along each side of the flight deck. The ships had guns, but not adequate anti-aircraft protection at that time. They were counting on their planes to protect them.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so when you got back to work then few days after Pearl Harbor then, what was your assigned responsibility at that time? Did they give you some new responsibilities then, or you were kind of in training, I guess?
I was assistant to Lieutenant Kell, who was a ship superintendent on the Russell, and we still had the Santee.
Mm-hmm.
And our job was to follow up, be sure the various crafts were getting their job done and getting done satisfactorily, and coordinating things between the ship's crews and the shipyard facilities. And it was just a general supervisory job, an inspection job.
How long does it did it take to build a naval vessel like the Russell? That was a destroyer, was it? What was that? What was the Russell?
The Russell was a destroyer. I don't recall.
Is it a year, 2 years, something of that nature?
It was probably on the order of 2 years. Later on, it became a whole lot faster than that.
Why did it become faster?
Well, out of necessity. One thing was...
And how did it become faster?
It became faster because we built huge components away from the dock, away from the building ways, and brought those in, sub-assemblies, you might say, maybe a whole deckhouse.
Oh, okay.
I recall recently that on one of the later carriers, that a sub-assembly weighing 750 tons was put in place in that carrier. Instead of a few hundred pounds of steel here and there being welded together, that had been built somewhere else and brought in 750 tons, which is a whole lot of metal.
It's kind of interesting because you're saying, though, that the shipyard then reacted to the need, you know, for faster production, and one way you did it was to do some outsourcing. You might not outsourcing, but building heavy components in other areas and bringing them in, huh?
That was still being done before the war, but it probably intensified after the war.
What was the toughest part of your job back then when you were trying to get these ships built? Any particular thing that really was the biggest challenge to you? Like people, maybe? I don't know. Maybe the...
Well, one of the things that bothered us a lot, we had a lot of good people working in the shipyard, and they were people who had been farmers, automobile mechanics, grocery clerks, or various other things maybe 6 months before, and they were now building ships.
So you had to hire a lot of people.
Right. And
that was a big
most
challenge.
Of them were very dedicated workers, but there were some that were making more money than they ever dreamed of, and it showed. That was upsetting at time. We thought it really would be a good thing if the shipyard got bombed, to wake people up, let them know we were at war.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it never happened except in Pearl Harbor.
Right. Did you ever have any scares along those lines while you were at the Norfolk Yard of any sabotage or anything of that nature?
None to my knowledge. We had some blackouts from time to time, but nothing of any consequence.
There were submarines, I guess, off the Atlantic coast,
oh, yes,
not too far out, so you were vulnerable to an extent. What was your, how many days a week did you work then, George? Were you 7 days a week, or what?
Well, we won't do the 6 days a week and seven if needed. Basically, we had Sundays off, though, unless we had the duty in the production department.
Uh-huh. And did you have any workers working on Sunday at all, or was this?
Oh, yes. Everything was 7 days a week,
so you were
24 hours a day.
24 hours a day, seven. Oh, okay, so you were actually 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You're right. The shipyard was.
Yeah, the shipyard. And then you had basically one day off a week.
Huh? Right.
The idea. Now, where were you living then?
I had a room in, well, living conditions were very crowded.
Yeah.
And some of these other young officers and I got a room in a private home. Three of us shared a room. And this was a private home out there in Portsmouth, and a lot of families in Portsmouth were doing the same thing to accommodate people who needed places to live, plus of course they had some additional income from it.
Right. Okay, so what was your normal day like on one of your 6 days a week that you were working? You were living in a private home, right? So it was kind of like...
Well, we were probably 15 minutes away from the yard, and we'd go in and report in, and then...
What time would you normally report in?
As I recall, it was 8 o'clock, and we were there till 5, and we went up to our various assignments in the yard. That is, if I were in new construction, I'd go down there, and One time I relieved an officer who was on leave and had to follow up on some material requirements in the various shops that were to be shipped to some minesweepers, which were down in the canal zone and the Caribbean. So I had some worthwhile work there for a couple of weeks while he was on leave. And one interesting aspect of that was that the yard covers a lot of ground, but there were bicycles available. Mm-hmm. So you could get a bicycle and go anywhere in the yard and had racks to park them in. And I saw Admiral Gajax, the Admiral, riding along the dock, all dressed out in his white. He was a short, stocky man, but he was riding a bicycle, and I nearly fell off watching him, seeing him in that relatively undignified position.
So your work day then was a pretty normal work day. Of course, when you left, there was somebody who filled in as a supervisory capacity after that.
Well, there was, in the production department, there was a duty officer covering the various jobs. Mm-hmm. The ship superintendents were inspectors of a sort. They were looking over the shoulders of the civilians and supporting the civilian force.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when you got off duty at 5 o'clock, what were your responsibilities at that point? Did you have any other further responsibilities to the Navy?
We went home, out to eat, because mm-hmm. eating conditions were not too good.
So you lived kind of a normal life, I guess.
Right.
And you were in Norfolk. Did you have occasion to go into town and do whatever you wanted to do in town? As you say, eat out and any recreation?
We had plenty of freedom. There were recreation. We went to some parties after a while. We got invited to parties in private homes. Every Saturday there was a dance at the officers' club, and in fact after Pearl Harbor the senior officers wondered whether we should continue those. Uh-huh. But they decided we should. Life had to go on, and everybody was working real hard and really needed to unwind once a week.
What kind of pressure did you feel from a day-to-day basis on your job? I mean, did you feel, we got to get these ships built, we got to get them out, we can't stand any delay?
At that time, I really had no responsibility except to learn all I could. Uh-huh. Later on, it became a pretty stressful life. I felt a lot of responsibility because the work that I was overseeing could mean the life or death of a whole lot of men if it wasn't done right.
Right. So how long did you continue then after Pearl Harbor in your particular first assignment? When did you go to another assignment?
Well, I was there until late February 1942, and during that time, USS Alabama was launched, and I was involved in the ceremonies there. Mm-hmm. Got a special invitation. I was on the...
Who christened the Alabama, do you recall?
I was Senator Lister Hill's wife. He was a senator from Alabama at the time.
I remember that name.
And I was not far from the main platform there. Uh-huh. I was in position so I could watch the ship go down the ways. One interesting aspect of that, well, a couple of things. One, I had worked for a few days with the Lieutenant O'Byrne on an improved way of putting the tower on the ways between the ground ways and the sliding ways. Mm-hmm. Historically, that had been done by taking about half to three-quarter inch slabs of tower and sliding them in the crevice which was left under there to serve as a lubricant when the ship went down the ways. Mm-hmm. What we worked on was a way to pump this in. The other method was very labor-intensive. I don't recall whatever came of that because I got pulled off of that for something else. And the other thing was that when the Alabama was launched, of course it was weighed about 23,000 tons at that point, wasn't completed. But there was a whole lot of mass moving down, and to check it, There were 10 clumps of anchor chain, each weighing 100 tons, tied by cables, five clumps on each side of the ship. So as the ship moved down the ways, it would pick up and drag these clumps of chains so that it would check the velocity of it after it got in the water. And it was right interesting to watch that, and everything went off well. Of course, they had done that before, so they knew what they were doing.
In kind of a non-technical way, tell me, you got this 23,000-ton vessel, okay, resting on what, wood? Are they wood beams of some kind?
Wooden ways. With wooden cradles, possibly some steel involved, but a whole lot of wood.
Now, they're resting on that, and how is the ship released to start its slide? What has to be done to make that ship start moving?
There's a tripping mechanism. It's chocked.
Uh-huh.
And when the champagne bottle is broken, somebody's signaling, they trip this tripping mechanism, which removes the chock, so it then gravity takes over.
Okay, so the ship is on these wooden, and maybe some metal involved, I guess.
Cradles, yes.
What is tallow the lubricant that causes this? And how do they get the tallow actually underneath the hull? Because that's where it's got to be.
Well, the hull is supported by these moving ways, the chocks.
Okay.
And the chocks, I don't recall exactly.
Are there any rollers involved?
No rollers.
It's
strictly a sliding motion.
Strictly gravity against a lubricated
ways.
Ways. And the ways.
Big, wide, flat wooden track.
Okay, but these, they have tallow on them. Is that the idea?
Right.
Okay.
That's the lubricant.
And I don't quite understand how the tallow gets under there, but anyway.
Historically, they used to put it under and just lay it under, slide it under in slabs. As I told you, Lieutenant O'Byrne and I were working on a method to pump it in as
a
liquid.
Yes. Uh-huh.
To remove a whole lot of the labor-intensive effort used in it.
So that's interesting. So you got all this is riding on tallow, huh?
Right.
So it takes it down in the gravity. That's very interesting. Did you ever have any mishaps in launching a ship of any kind?
No, I was
pretty routine most of the time.
I was up at. We'll talk about this later on. I'll mention it now. I was at Camden, New Jersey, when the USS Independence, which was the first CVL, that is a carrier, which was built on what originally had been intended to be a light cruiser hull.
Uh-huh.
And I was there for the launching of the Independence, the first of that class. The ship had been started well on the way on construction as a cruiser. But then we found out we needed carriers more than we needed cruisers, so it was converted and finished as a carrier. Well, when they launched it, it started moving very slowly, but there's a hydraulic ram to give it a nudge. Well, they were pumping frantically on the hydraulic ram, and it couldn't quite keep up with the ship, but fortunately it did take off and move. So I expect a lot of people's heart quit beating there for a few minutes.
Yeah, no doubt. Break the champagne and the ship stays there. Okay, well anyway, continuing on with your, I guess your career at the Navy Yard, then when did you get some additional duties and so forth?
Well,
about what time?
We went there. We knew we were destined to go to a Naval Architecture School up to postgraduate school in Annapolis in February. But after Pearl Harbor, we figured, gee, we young engineers, they're going to send us to sea. But they didn't. They sent us on up there. There were six of us from Norfolk Navy Yard, and a total of about 80-something in the class at Annapolis. And we went ahead with that program. The class up there started in February. 42.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so you were in school then at Annapolis?
Yes, we went there.
And what subjects were you taking that you'd never taken prior to that point? Or was everything new?
Well, let me cover the courses briefly. This was a session of three 10-week courses.
Uh-huh.
The first 10 weeks, we covered, one course that we covered was mathematics from arithmetic through differential equation, which was a review for most of us. A few of the architects hadn't had much math. We also studied warship design, strength of materials, a lot of book work, required a lot of homework, and we got quizzed every week. And everybody was anxious to make a good mark, to be a pie up on the list. So the first 10 weeks was a whole lot of book work. The second 10 weeks wasn't quite as intense. We got into some lab work, including an excellent lab in metallurgy, both of ferrous and non-ferrous metals, where we actually polished samples, examined them under the microscope, sketched the structure and the austenitic, martensitic, various structures, to which was an indication of the metallurgical strength and qualities of the material. That was a course that I learned a lot in, and used even a lot later in my engineering. We had some various engineering courses. I guess then we got into warship design, some field trips. And then the third week period, we did a whole lot of board work and actually laying out the lines of the hull of a ship, which is a pretty complex thing when you have no flat surfaces. The surfaces that curve in all directions, but they have to all fit together.
Right.
The ribs have to be fitted by the shell plating, so it's a real interesting and complex thing. And we actually did all the board work of designing a ship's hull.
So you actually designed, did you have time actually to design a ship as part of your
project? We had to lay out the lines on it, yes.
Okay. So this was, you say, what, 30 weeks then?
3 10-week sessions.
Three 10-week sessions. Now, when you were in Annapolis at that time.
Yes.
And what was the atmosphere around Annapolis? Did you live on base, at the academy, or were you...
No, there were no quarters available. And the group ahead of us was a classmate of mine from Georgia Tech, and he knew I was in the group coming up there, so he and seven other fellows had rented two apartments and acquired some dime store china and pots and pans, and they hired a cook, and they had that set up and wanted to know if we wanted to take it over. That suited us fine. So the six from Norfolk, plus two friends that I knew were up at Philadelphia Navy Yard, I had known in Atlanta in indoctrination school. So the eight of us took those facilities over, and we lived like kings as far as our living accommodation.
Yeah,
this was
good.
At a place called Dreams Landing, which was out on the Severn River. With the eight of us bought a sailboat together, so. And when summertime came on, that was fortunately when we were doing the board work in the daytime and had a lot of long afternoons, we were able to sail.
Oh, good.
So the eight of us hired we took over the cook the previous group had, and she fixed three meals a day, 7 days a week, except Sunday nights we had cold cuts. And she kept up two apartments, including making the beds, and at least once she washed and ironed the drapers in both apartments. Did a good job, but we had to pay her $17 a week.
Tough.
That was in 1942 dollars.
Yeah, right. Still sounds pretty reasonable. In Annapolis, then, what was the security like? Was there any special security around the Naval Academy or in the city? Did you have any air raid tests of any kind, of anything of that nature that was going on while you were there?
I'm not aware of any. We had Marine guards on all the gates, but that was routine anyway.
Yeah.
I suspect they were careful about who they let in the gate,
right.
But after a while, they know the same people going in and out.
So it was fairly routine, I guess, from that standpoint. Okay, after your 30 weeks there, then what happened to you?
Let me mention a couple other things about that. We had some neighbors out at Dreams Landing were families of naval officers at sea. Right next to us, there was the family of a Navy captain, and he was a commanding officer of a Navy cargo ship. I've forgotten the name of it, but he came in occasionally. And the other apartment right next door to that, there was a family of Army medical officer who was a colonel, and he was over in England. So they had a young boy and a girl, so we were sort of big brothers to all these kids in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Another family lived across the street from us, and she suddenly disappeared one day, and her husband was in a submarine in the Pacific, and they'd come into the West Coast, and she was able to get a flight out.
And she was lucky to get a flight.
She got back after about a week.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So where did your Navy life lead you after that, then?
Well, after that, we were asked what our choices would be for duty stations, and since I was from the South, I had put Charleston Navy Yard. We were obviously going to Navy Yard somewhere, ship construction somewhere. And Norfolk Navy Yard was my second choice, but I got orders to Norfolk Navy Yard. Of the eight of us in that apartment, three were sent to Pearl Harbor, two had been up at Philadelphia Navy Yard, was sent back to Philadelphia Navy Yard, and they were both natives of Philadelphia, so that worked out well. One of us stayed on as an instructor. Four out of each class were held over as instructors for the following class. And one was sent to May Island. Don't know whether I've accounted for everybody or not, but anyway, and I was sent back to Norfolk Navy Yard. Mm-hmm.
So you went back home, you might say, where you'd spent several months
right.
before. And of course you had different duties now, though.
Well, things were sort of slack at the yard at the time, and I was given sort of assigned some odd jobs. Mm-hmm. One thing I recall, we had a bunch of YMSs, which is about a 250-ton wooden hull minesweeper designed for sweeping electronic mines. And they went there and they had a crates and crates and crates of supplies for the engines, primarily the engines. And no way they could carry them, so I was among the group to try to decide what to do with the problem. It wasn't solved before I went somewhere else. In hindsight, I realized at the time I was probably being evaluated for my future assignments, which was in Baltimore.
Turn tape now.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side one. The interview continues on tape B, side 1. Side A, 2 was blank.
Okay, we were talking about the repair ship for the PT boats, I guess.
And yes. The tank deck made an excellent machine shop. It was about, I don't know, seemed to be 120, 30 feet long plus 30 feet wide. And on either side, there were compartments at two levels, and they were about 10 feet wide, and they made excellent offices, storage room for parts, and smaller material, the heavy plate and lumber, that sort of thing was stored in racks and deck houses, which had been added on the main deck of the LST. The LST also had the advantage that the bow door could be open, the ramp lowered so that a boat could come alongside load material directly into the shop space, mm-hmm. down a ramp inside the ship, but anyway, directly into the shop space rather than having to hoist it up and down through a hatch.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So the LST was an excellent ship in many respects that we even used for aircraft carriers,
yeah,
as you might know, for
flexible use.
Piper Cubs.
Piper Cubs, okay. Oh my, I hadn't heard of that. At this time frame now, we're probably talking, what, 43, early 44, somewhere in that area, or maybe a little later than that?
Yeah, 44, yeah.
44, now. Okay. What's coming down to you as an officer in the Navy from your chain of command as to, you know, the status of things, the status of the war, what part that you were playing in it, and the changes and the different requirements that, like you were pointing out, the different the types of ships you were building and so forth. Did you feel like you were well informed as to what was kind of going on in the military at that time, or are you kind of just doing your...
I was
intense
told all I needed to know.
Uh-huh.
At one point, we were building destroyer escorts were being built.
Uh-huh.
And we were needing those for anti-submarine work, escorting ships to Europe,
uh-huh.
against the German submarines. And we were asked if we could take on any finishing up of destroyer escorts,
uh-huh.
that is, they would be basically built
elsewhere
and launched, like partially completed in the yard, and they'd come down to us to be finished.
I see.
So I went with a group of the shipyard executives up to Newark, New Jersey to look into this thing, and we decided that it probably wouldn't fit into what we were doing, and it suited me fine, because that was just an entirely different type ship from what we were doing. That yard was geared up to handle merchant ships in peacetime,
mm-hmm.
and what we were doing basically was taking merchant ships and adding some additional facilities to make a naval auxiliary vessel out
mm-hmm.
of it.
I see.
But our personnel, our material people, and we had very high material priority in our work, but our material people kept running up against something every now and then called the Manhattan Project.
Oh, no
doubt.
They
didn't know what it was, but they knew they had a high priority. Of course, later on we found out what the Manhattan Project
mm-hmm.
was.
Did you have any inkling at this time of what the Manhattan Project was, or just...
No, I didn't even know it existed.
I see.
But our material people...
Was that terminology used with your material? I mean, was that a term that you...
Well, it probably wasn't put in writing.
Yeah.
But they would run up against it sometimes.
They knew there was some project going that required material that you needed, I guess.
Yeah. Of course, you realize that Truman didn't even know we had the atomic bomb when he became president.
That's right. He sure did.
That's how secret it was.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Okay, well, let's continue on then. George, you were continuing on there, I guess, at that shipyard until... Did you have any duty where you got out into the fleet on any fleet activities as an observer or anything at all?
Well, when we finished these ships, an officer accompanied them from Baltimore down to either Naval Operating Base Norfolk or Navy Yard Norfolk, depending on whether or not additional work had to be done,
uh-huh.
pretty much as an observer. And that came about apparently because word came back that you wanted another ship made it down the bay without sinking because all of the sorry work the shipyard had done.
Uh-huh.
But this was sort of to look after the Baltimore area's interests on these ships.
Uh-huh.
And on one of those trips, this was in an LST type hull, ARBAGP, Battle Damage Repair Ship, or motor torpedo boat, tender, one of those. I stayed up half the night with the ship's crew trying to get the evaporator operating. But this was a matter of lack of experience on their part. It was not a problem. They would get the vacuum almost built up and then they'd lose the vacuum. But there again, it was a matter of lack of experience. Mm-hmm. On another one, the ship had to shut down the main engines because the cooling water pump had clogged up with some debris in the suction from the sea. Mm-hmm. And the ship didn't know how to convert over to other operation. But there again, it was lack of experience. On one of the LS, on one of the Liberty ship hull ships, the ship boiler feed water pump lost its suction because the ship had let the water run out of the sump, and they didn't know how to, weren't experienced enough to change over to the steam injectors. Mm-hmm. But so they had to, they lost power for a few minutes. This is a matter of minutes. There again, it was a lack of experience. Mm-hmm. But those trips were all quite interesting. We'd run the degaussing range, and then on one, at least one ship, well, the ARG-4, the Tutter Wheeler, we ran the speed range, and the Liberty ship was designed, I think, for speed of 11.4 knots, and they were around that range at 13.1 knots, but the ship was light. It was not as deep in the water as it would normally be. And all the ships I went on got there all right. Mm-hmm. We did have one incident where, well, when we finished the ship in the yard, the supplies were loaded up at Port Covington, another pier closer to downtown Baltimore. And among the things that we couldn't put on in the yard were the fire hoses because welding sparks would burn them and that sort of thing. And machine tool parts couldn't be put on. A lot of things we put on after it got up there. Mm-hmm. Well, one of these ships started down the bay and started hooking up their fire hoses and found out the fire hoses wouldn't fit the nozzle valve. So they were going down the bay without any fire protection. Mm-hmm. But that was a... That's when I learned that there were several different standards for fire hose threads in the United States. Now, why, I don't recall, but anyway, somebody had gotten crossed up.
Yeah, right.
But that didn't happen but once.
Right. Okay, anything else you want to talk about before we get into some other things there?
Well, when the war ended, of course, everybody went home that had enough points, yeah, but I wasn't one of them. I was unmarried and had been overseas.
Now, this is victory in Europe you're talking about.
Victory in Europe and later victory in Japan. Okay. Well, let me talk about victory in Europe.
Yeah, talk about that first. What happened to you?
What happened to me? I didn't get anything to eat that night because all the eating places closed up. And everybody went home.
How did you hear about this, over the radio, or did they announce it at your work?
Well, we were, at that time, going way back, we were supposed to take a half a day off every week for recreational purposes. Mm-hmm. But the only people I know that did it were the people down in the planning department. But anyway, we had acquired a baseball league, and we were playing softball over in one of the parks, and the wives of one of the officers had a radio when we learned about war being over in Europe. Mm-hmm. So
there's some hoops and hollers about when that happened, huh?
And I don't recall what happened when I learned about the war being over in Japan, but I recall that neither time did I get into supper that night, which didn't bother me too much.
After VE Day, what happened to your priorities at your shipbuilding facility there?
Well,
how did that change your activities, if it did?
Well, we still had some ships in there, and As I recall, we went to a 5-day week right off. Uh-huh. That slowed down. Uh-huh. And some of the ships we stopped work on. Some went ahead and finished. Uh-huh. Because they were so far along. In fact, the prospective crews were already there. Mm-hmm. But then we started getting ships in for decommissioning. And that was utter chaos. These ships had been out in the South Pacific. We had quite a few diesel-driven cargo ships, AKs.
Yeah.
And had three holds. They were probably about 5,000-ton ships, relatively small.
Mm-hmm.
And they came in and tied up the dock, and everybody left, the way it looked to me. You'd go aboard the ship. The shipyard had the responsibility of being sure the ship was secure, wouldn't sink, but there was stuff strewn everywhere. And all we had to do was just throw it away, a lot of valuable stuff.
Well, what is the decommissioning process? You were responsible for the decommissioning of that ship?
No.
No?
It had been, I wasn't responsible for the actual decommissioning and relieving the commanding officer, that sort of thing, but the shipyard was responsible for taking
what
left,
okay,
and to be sure it was in proper order so that it could be sent to a reserve fleet or somewhere.
Now, the ship had already been decommissioned at
that
point.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
But we just sent people home too fast. And about that time, the planning officer was deactivated, and I was transferred downtown as planning officer for the Baltimore area. And I got into all of this business of handling the decommissioned ships,
mm-hmm,
and also renegotiating the contracts and deciding what we were going to do with the ships that we had. And there were some changes in the contracts. I didn't get involved in that. But anyway, there was a state of chaos, the transferring from a wartime status back to a peacetime status. The shipyards wanted to dump everything. They wanted to get back to merchant business.
Yeah.
That was their regular business.
Let me just get back to this decommission. Was your responsibility then to prepare that vessel to go to the reserve fleet or wherever it was to go?
Not to the extent of mothballing and all that, but it was to prepare it to be sure that it wouldn't sink at the dock.
Yeah, uh-huh.
That sort of thing.
Oh, you had to make sure that it was.
And be sure it was cleaned up, and all the debris and dunnage and that kind of stuff was all from
it. And it was watertight and
right,
at the point where it could be put into a reserve fleet. Uh-huh.
We had one commanding officer came in, and his biggest worry was that he had picked up an army duck somewhere in the South Pacific that wasn't supposed to have, and he was afraid he was going to get court-martialed for having it on board his ship. He said, "I wish I'd dumped it over the side coming up Chesapeake Bay," but nobody cared about that sort of thing. And he could have driven it home and nobody would have cared.
Were you around then long enough to know what happened to some of these vessels that were in their midpoint in construction, or just, what actually happened to some of these vessels that were not completed? Some were completed, but what happens to the ones that weren't completed?
Well, they were basically merchant hulls.
Uh-huh.
Some were LST hulls, some were LST, well, ARL, which is a landing craft repair ship,
uh-huh,
which had come back from South Pacific, and I just don't know what happened to, uh-huh, those. I'm sure they went to reserve fleet somewhere with just enough maintenance to be sure they wouldn't sink, that sort of thing.
But the ones where you did, including those where you just had almost just a basic hull and that was it, I mean, what happened to those ships? Did they scrap them? Did they sell them to somebody else?
No, they were probably sold as merchant merchant holds.
To somebody else who completed them, is that the idea? Or maybe it was completed at your shipyard.
The ships that we got in were basically completed merchant hulls.
Uh-huh.
Maybe some of the fine finishing points hadn't been done, but they were operating ships.
Okay, so they could have been sold to somebody else as another type.
I just don't recall what happened. I really wasn't concerned with that part of it at the time. I was pushing paperwork, and one thing I recall, that the shipyard had a lot of drawings to finish on ships that they had done the design work on, hadn't completed the finished drawing. I told you, a lot of time we built the ship from sketches, and the draftsman was on the ship as it was leaving to find out what had been done so he could make the drawings. Well, the shipyard wanted to be relieved of that responsibility, so I made a trip over to the Bureau of Ships. Captain Ward, my commanding officer, let me use his station wagon and chauffeur, went over there to the Bureau of Ships to see if I could convince them that this was a waste of time. Some of these ships that they were making drawings for had already been converted back to merchant vessels, decommissioned back in service as merchant vessels. But anyway, the man I dealt with was a commander called Finn Ronnie. This was in 1946. And he was an Arctic explorer. In 1948, he led an expedition to the Antarctic Ocean, to Antarctica for the Navy. Mm. Finn Ronnie.
Mm-hmm.
But I got nowhere with him. I mean, I'm supposed to go by the book, see.
Yeah, right.
So, while I was over in the Bureau of Ships, I saw crossroads around, and I asked this Commander Kell, he was then, he was my boss at the time of Pearl Harbor, he was Lieutenant Junior Grade Kell.
Mm-hmm.
I saw him, I said, Walt, what are all of these crossroads? I said, out in bomb tests. So I thought, well, gee, that'd be interesting. So I found out where they were and went in to see if they needed somebody with a ship construction experience to evaluate ship damage. Oh yeah, I mean, and the first thing, see if we got room for Commander Ziegler on the warden. Anyway, the first thing I had to have a place for me to sleep.
And where were you actually now?
Where was I?
You were transferred to another location now?
No, I was in planning office, but I was over in Bureau of Ships trying to take care of this job.
Okay.
Well, anyway, we can take you. I said, by that time, I already had my separation orders.
Uh-huh.
So I was on the way out. So
even before Virginia, obviously, then. You're on your way out already, huh?
Oh, no. This was March 46. This is way on late.
Oh, I was thinking that it was the original atomic bomb that you were...
Oh, no, no, huh?
Okay.
But this was a test at Bikini, Operation Crossroad.
Okay.
Well, so anyway, they said, you have to agree to stay on for the duration of the test. And I said, no, I don't know. Well, anyway, no later than December 1946. I said, well, I'll agree to that. Well, sign this piece of paper. I said, you type it up, and then I'll sign it. So anyway, when I got back, Captain Ward had already received the dispatch ordering me to Bureau of Ships, canceling my separation orders, and he was very unhappy. He'd been asked me to transfer to the regular Navy. I was his right-hand man, and I was leaving him. But anyway, the other thing he was unhappy about, I had his chauffeur in the station wagon. He was ready to go home. So anyway, I got orders to the Bureau of Ships. This was long March, I guess. Went over to the Bureau of Ships, got involved in some of the planning for the Bureau of Ships part of that. And then in May, left the Bureau of Ships group by a special train to Oakland, California, boarded the Warden, went to Pearl Harbor, stayed there about 10 days, then on to Bikini, got out there late May, and the atom bomb test July 1st and July 23rd, the underwater test, and the radioactivity was just totally beyond anything they had expected. So after the underwater test, everything was at a standstill. Mm-hmm. So I was supposed to come back, I was supposed to be back by the end of August, and I was coming back on the one of the hospital ships, which was the base for the, they had two hospital ships out there, they were the base for the radiological teams with a lot of doctors involved there. And but with the radiological mess that they encountered, they held them out there, so I wound up flying back from Bikini. Left out there about the middle of August, and back to Butte ships, and got separated at the end of October. Okay, or at the end of August.
Okay, let's get back to the Bikini test now. The day you were there, the day, or the several, well, how many bombs went off at Bikini?
Two. Yeah.
Two, okay. You were there for both of them.
Yeah, number four and number five in
okay.
history.
Tell me about, just briefly, what that day was like and what protective gear you wore and where you, how far from the blast you were and that kind of thing. Just
well,
to put this in context.
A lot went on out there before that. This was to evaluate the effect of atomic bomb on ships.
Okay.
And other military gear. Like the Army had a bunch of trucks, tanks, guns, mm-hmm. like the deck of the Saratoga was just covered with a lot of Army equipment exposed to these bomb tests.
Mm-hmm.
There were a number of transports out there. You've read about all of this.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah, a lot of animals, goats and pigs, were tethered for exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And that took a lot of preparatory work. My job was administrative assistant to Captain Forrest, who was also in charge of the Bureau of Ships group. And specifically, I had two chief yeomen. One had been in Navy Air, another had been in Navy Submarines, both very good guys. And we had about 40 yeomen. And our job was to write up the reports of these inspection parties. And my job was to coordinate all that, be sure it was done, and I'd get reports from two different porters that looked at the same thing and said they saw opposite things. I had to decide which one I wanted to put in the report. My job every night was to write up a summary report of what happened that day with the Bureau of Ships group, and I'd do that after dinner. Then I'd go to the movie, and the duty yeoman would type it up, and I'd come back down there and go over it and take it to Captain Forrest for his signature, usually about 9 or 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
So mine was a job of pushing paper around, although I did get out on some of the ships. And they had recreational facilities over on the island of Bikini. Bill was a dime. Warm bill it was, and highballs for 15 cents, and it was...
Where were you when the blast went off?
Well, we had a rehearsal for the blast a few days beforehand. That's to be sure that all the ships could get out and everything was the way it was supposed to be the day of the blast. Well, then after that rehearsal, all the ships came back in, and then the day before the actual blast was to take place, all the inspection parties left the ship to get on the smaller vessel so they could go in quicker. And Captain Forrest was going to be flying around in a PBY observing from the air and sending and reporting back by radio, and we could listen to his reports from that. And so we left the day before, the afternoon before. We're talking about 50 to 100 ships out there milling around.
Is that right?
At night. See, there were about 25,000 people out there. A lot of people out there.
Didn't recollect there were that many people involved in ships.
And, well, the crews for the target ships won. Uh-huh. Some of those had been already sent home. Uh-huh. But there were crews for a lot of the service vessels out there, like our ship. And so we would see that night, and then we started the countdown the next morning. And as I recall, they would at 30 minutes before the time of the blast, they'd time every 5 minutes. Then down the last 5 minutes, they'd count every minute. And then the last 10 seconds, they'd count it by second. And it went right on, almost exactly on time. Mm-hmm. Of course, this was a...
How far were you from the blast?
On the airburst, we were about 17 miles.
And you were aboard what?
Aboard the Warden.
Aboard the Warden, okay. What did you have on? What kind of... Did you have any special clothing
no,
on?
No regular clothes.
How about your eyes?
We had goggles, heavy goggles. There weren't very many of those. About 10% of people had goggles. And I had a pair, but there was some concern whether they were going to give you adequate protection, so I elected not to use mine. Mm-hmm. So what I did then, the procedure was to turn away from the blast, face the bulkhead, and on our ship there was an overhead deck, and then close your eyes, and then put the crook of your elbow over your eyes to cover them with your arm. And even then, I could sense when that light went off. It was that bright. And of course, once the flash is gone, then you could turn around and look. And I turned around and watched the whole development of the bomb from the first puff through my binoculars. And it was really a sight to see. I've got the letter that I wrote home at the time describing that in detail, if you'd like to read that sometime.
How did the... Then you had an underwater blast too, right?
Yes.
And how many days later was that?
That was the first one on July 21st. The second one was on July 23rd.
And how did that one differ from the first one? Any of your preparation and so forth that you were involved in?
Well,
if it did.
After the first one, of course, there was a lot of some ships were sunk, mm-hmm. And the Japanese cruiser, the Sakawa, was sunk, and I watched it sink. I was maybe a mile away and just watched it over a period of several hours while it slowly settled by the stern, heeled over and sank. And it's really something to see a great big ship sink.
Now, did the Saratoga was there, you said?
Sakawa.
Excuse me, I'm talking about our... Did you say we had an aircraft carrier, the Saratoga?
The Saratoga sank after the second blast.
Okay,
the Baker test.
Okay.
But the Sakawa sank. I watched it sink. It was near the center of the target array. Mm-hmm. But the Army Air Corps bomber missed it by, I think, about 1,000 yards. I mean, but you don't have to have a atomic bomb right on the dot.
Well, I would say not.
But people ask me, did you hear the blast? Never did hear a blast. We knew how far away we were, and we know how pressure waves will travel at the speed of sound, and we knew about when it was, so we felt a slight puff.
But no sound?
No sound.
That's incredible.
On the underwater blast, you could feel that. Through the ship, there we were about 11 miles away, uh-huh. And there was an island and reefs between us. We were out in the ocean. This was in the lagoon. But even then, you could feel the shock through the water in the hull of the ship. And a fish alongside broke water at that time. The fish felt the shock too. There was no flash there, it was all underwater. That was something to see too. You've probably seen these huge columns of water coming up with the mushroom on the top.
And you could watch that through your binoculars.
Yes.
So there was no...
We could watch that, and of course we could see the target vessels too.
Uh-huh. And what happened to those target vessels?
Well, some sank, some of various stages of damage. One thing of interest there was, and that shows up in the pictures, after the airburst, You see a black plume over all the ships, and we decided later what it was. The shock loosened the soot in the uptakes, and then the vacuum created sucked all that out. So you're seeing smoke. This smoke, this soot was being pulled out of the ship, and it was over every steamship. That's over its stack.
Yeah.
And we wondered.
So there's a tremendous vacuum, and it actually sucked all the debris and stuff right out of the ship.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I went aboard.
Let me ask you this, George. From a philosophical standpoint, you know, as you observed these tests, did you have any thoughts run through your mind? What have we, of course you already knew about the, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki and all that, but did your thought go through your mind any at all? What in the world have we unleashed here?
No. My job was you had to accept you had it. And my job was to help evaluate what you had to do to a ship to make the ship survivable. And of course, it's quite evident that a lot was going to have to be done, but it all resolved down structurally. It didn't make any difference because the radioactivity made the ship unlivable anyway.
Yeah.
So the radioactivity would put any of the ships out of service.
So what happened to all those ships? They were radioactive. They sink them there?
Some were brought back to the States, like the aircraft Independence, which I had seen launched up at Camden in 1942. It was a target vessel, and the flight deck down the center up forward just went up like the peak of a roof. And the with some repairs, the Independence survived both tests and was able.
Wasn't it radioactive?
There was some radioactivity, but not not that great. There were probably some areas. I went aboard the Independence after the test, and you could go only up on the forecastle. You couldn't go all over the ship due to radioactivity and unsafe structural conditions. But Prince Eugen, which was a German cruiser, the most beautiful ship I've ever seen, was a target vessel, and it was towed down to Kwajalein and tried to beach it, and it was it capsized, and it's still, I'm sure, still in the lagoon down to Kwajalein.
Have you ever had any concerns about your own physical health after being there with the radioactivity and all the rest?
No. Extreme precautions were taken to protect people from radioactivity. And I read these things, I've seen things on TV about people that were exposed. And if they were exposed, it was their own fault because they were told what to do and what not to do, unless somebody might have ordered somebody to do something, somebody who was stupid ordered somebody to do something that they shouldn't have. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I didn't have a radioactivity badge, but there were a lot of radioactivity badges, and each inspection team was accompanied by a radiological man who went aboard, and he had to approve where people could go on the ship. Mm-hmm. So extreme precautions were taken to protect people against radioactivity. And I did receive some communication from some commission assigned later on telling me what the radioactivity was on the ship where I was based, the Wharton. Mm-hmm. But I was off of that ship, and most of the people in the Bureau of Ships group were off making inspections, so that really meant nothing, but it was a very low level. Mm-hmm. My exposure was very low. But the lagoon was radioactive, and they brought water aboard. We couldn't make water with the evaporators on the ship. Had a water tanker, brought water aboard for us.
Because of the concern about radioactivity
right.
in the water?
It had made water at sea somewhere, yeah. You know, brought water in from somewhere.
How long were you there after the second explosion?
About 3 weeks. I left there on August 15th, and this was on July 23rd.
And then you were kind of on your way out of the service at that point?
Well, that's right. I went back to Bureau of Ships and really had not a whole lot to do. Commander Waters in charge of the group back at the Bureau of Ships, and I helped him on some paperwork matter, resolving some cleanup items.
Mm-hmm.
But out at Bikini, I did a whole lot in the preparation of a report, which we were told was going to President Truman, evaluating structural damage to ships. Some ships were sunk, and the underwater photography was not very good, but you could make out some things, and I wrote up some of the evaluations on particularly a couple of destroyers,
mm-hmm.
Pointing out what this was and describing what the picture showed.
Okay, so you your career was winding down then, and you went back to was it Philadelphia Navy Yard?
No, I went back to Bureau of Ships, and
two weeks
later I was separated at the Navy receiving station there in Washington.
Okay.
On August 30th.
So if you got out of the Navy on August 30th, then did you have kind of plans what you were going to do at that point, or you?
No, I thought about going back to school, but see, I was 28 years old and never had a job, so I figured I'd better go to work somewhere.
I would say you had a job. You didn't have a...
Well, I didn't have a Social Security number. So I went home, and a lot of jobs were available,
uh-huh.
and I'd made up my mind I wasn't going to go to work for 3 months, but I couldn't wait that long.
Was it relatively easy to find a job, even with all the people getting out of the service?
Oh, yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I would have thought the reverse.
But there was one problem, though. A 28-year-old engineer was not as acceptable as a 21-year-old fresh out of college.
Even with your experience?
Huh?
Even with your experience?
Yeah, my experience didn't mean anything to most people. I was just a naval officer.
Yeah, but you had a world of experience.
Yeah, I did. I had an awful lot of good experience.
So what did you decide to do then at that point? You took off a while.
Well, I went home. My mother and father were living in Tallahassee, Florida at the time. They'd mm-hmm. moved that down there during the war. And I went home and actually had people calling me about jobs, and finally wound up going to...
Why don't you give just a little thumbnail of what your career has been since then, just a little highlight of what your career has been.
Since I got out of the Navy?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, a friend of mine who I'd been in junior college with, and who was in the class behind me at the Naval Academy, and he also had an appointment to the Naval Academy in 37 when I had mine. He was a second alternate, and I was a principal, and we figured I'd get in, and he might. Well, he got in and stayed the year, and his eyes got him. And he was at Georgia Tech after me, a year behind me at that time, because he had wasted a year at the Naval Academy. And then he had gotten out, went to work for the Kendall Company, textile organization, and he saw my name on the list that Georgia Tech got out of people available, so he gave me a call, wanted me to come to work for him up in Pelzer, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I went up there and talked to them, but this was not a job I was interested in, so I went back home. And then the assistant works manager up in the divisional office in Charlotte gave me a call. He wanted me to come back up there, and I said, well, been down that road. But anyway, he prevailed on me to come up there, and they offered me a job in the engineering department. There they were modernizing, getting ready to modernize their mills. And it was an interesting job, but it was a dead-end job because my boss was only about 10 years older than I was, and I just had nowhere to go.
Yeah.
So they made a place for me to go, though. I think they suspected I was going to leave, and I had been working closely with the person department on these machinery jobs at the mills. I was practically a purchasing agent, although I was in the engineering department. So the works manager asked me if I'd be interested in coming to the person department and taking over as head of the department in a couple of years. The then head of the department was going to move to Boston to become director of purchases for the company. So it was at that time I got married. I moved out of engineering into purchasing. And I was an assistant purchasing agent for a couple of years and then took over the department. And I ran the department, I guess, for 7 years. And the Kendall Company, purchasing agents didn't stay there more than 4 or 5 years. They moved on to other things. So I set a record, I think, as purchasing manager at Kendall. And I was looking for something else, so they moved me over into a staff manufacturing job, which I was not interested in. It was a broadening experience.
Yeah.
But I had no interest in going into manufacturing, so I started looking around and got a chance to come to Fieldcrest as an engineer. I had the experience they needed. They had the job I was looking for, so I came up here in 1964.
Turn tape now.
Editor's note, end of tape B, side one. The interview continues on tape B, side two.
Concluded. Okay, you came to Fieldcrest then in 64?
I came here in actually October 63, moved my family up here in April 64, and built this house in summer of 66, and been here ever since.
Mm-hmm.
In engineering, I was a project engineer, did quite a bit of work at Fieldale, modernizing the tower mill, put in a lot of new looms, a lot of new spinning, all new slovers, well, all the manufacturing processes. Also put in the first modern packaged die machines and the modern Vista dryer, which is a big improvement over the way of drying dyed yarn, packaged dyed yarn, mm-hmm. and beamed dyed yarn. Did some work at the bedspread mill where we completely modernized the carding and spinning. Did the same work in the dye house there. Down at the blanket mill, put in a lot of new looms, a lot of new jackets for the looms. Did some little work in the stock dye house down there, not a whole lot. I did put in the first quality control lab down there, which was an interesting job, designing and getting that material in. My last jobs in engineering was they were planning to double the size of the Laurel Hill carpet yarn manufacturing, so I had that assignment, and we'd already worked up the layout plans for doubling the size of the building and what additional machinery we were going to buy and what we were going to move. And I was also at the same time working on designing a new washer range for the carpet mill. And I know whether you're familiar with the washer range, that's where they take the rugs and put them in one end and run through a combination of a chlorine slurry finish and rinse that off and run it through, I've forgotten the super ammonia, rinse that off and some acid and rinse that off, and then to take it through and dry it is to put the finish on that wool rug, you know. And the old one was leaking more chemicals than it was using, so I had worked up the design and was all ready to let the contract on that when I was asked if I'd like to take over the mechanical development department. Mr. McIsaac had been there a number of years and he wanted to retire. Well, that was looked like a good opportunity, so, but I asked, well, who's going to do this thing? Well, my boss said, I hadn't thought about that. Well,
you got to do that too.
Yeah. But anyway, after I was supposed to go up there January 1st, I've forgotten what year, but it was finally about May before I got out of engineering. In the meantime, I'd been assigned the business of noise control in the textile mill. That was a big problem, still is a big problem. Yeah. And I was making a lot of headway, and it was a very interesting assignment. Well, after I finally went up to mechanical development, took over that job, and you won't believe some of the administrative problems and personnel problems and all kinds of problems I ran into, but I have no regrets about what I did up there. But then they wanted me to keep the noise control job. Well, I had no interest in that. I mean, that stayed blunt in engineering, so it was turned over to somebody else, and I don't think anything ever happened to noise control after that. But that's a very important aspect of engineering in the textile mill. Mm-hmm. It's important from the standpoint of the people. Well, I was in mechanical development, I guess about, from it seemed like about 1972 to 1982. And I was, it got so work was not fun anymore because there was turmoil throughout the company. You know what has happened to you, Chris. Sure. It was beginning then.
Yeah.
And going to work wasn't fun anymore. So I retired a year early.
Mm-hmm. That in 83 then? Or
this what? No, this was August 1st of August, 82.
But
what happened there, and the kind of thing, I was told I had to get rid of two soured employees. I had come down from the board of directors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think the board of directors was capable of running my department. If they wanted me to cut back some way, okay. So I had to lay off a draftsman, been there about 26 years.
Mm-hmm.
That was only the best way to go from the company's point of view. I had hired a new electronic technician, but I had a vacant slot on my hourly payroll, and I was able to transfer him to that at about the same income, and it suited him fine because he was newly married, and he'd rather get paid once a week than once a month. So anyway, that worked out. So I finally lost one man, and I told my boss that I wish he had let me retire early, that I made a whole lot more than both these put together. He said, no, it's got to be two heads. That's the other thing. We were heads. We weren't people or personalities.
Yeah, I know.
We were heads.
Right.
And there had to be two heads. Well, anyway, and I said, well, but he said, don't let me say I stood in your way. This was on a Wednesday. I said, you mean I can retire? They were offering you a separation pay of a week's salary for every year you'd work. So that would have meant about 20 weeks salary. And I was going to retire 20 weeks, 5 months. I was going to retire 7 months later. So I figured, gee, I might as well go ahead and retire now rather than work 7 months for 2 months salary.
Yep.
So I said, I'll call you in the morning. So I spoke to Ben, and I already checked to see what my retirement benefits were going to be, so I knew about where I stood. She thought it was a great idea. So on Thursday, I told my boss that I was going to retire. And he said, well, don't say anything. I want to come up and announce. He was afraid that he was going to get blamed for retiring me. So he came up and announced it to my department the next day. And it was Saturday morning. We had already planned to leave for the beach for a week, so the best vacation I ever had. Then I came back and worked a month as a contract employee to clean up a lot of loose ends for my successor.
So you've been happy ever after?
Oh yeah, yours? Best thing I ever did.
Let me ask another quick question here, and just kind of, you might say, a little housekeeping questions, I guess you'd say. What do you think of the leadership that you experienced when you were in the service? The people that you worked for and so forth? How would you qualify them?
I thought it was very good. I had no problem with it. At Maryland Dry Dock, I had an immediate supervisor who got in my way sometimes. I had responsibilities, and sometimes if people didn't like my decision, they'd go to him and he would reverse them unknowingly. That happened several times and upset him when he found out what he'd done, but that was just his nature. Mm-hmm. He was a very intense person. In fact, at one time, he was ordered to take a week's leave. And in fact, at one time, I was ordered to take a week's leave. Well, what happened was we were told that we were in a slack period, everybody better get some leave.
Yeah.
But this commander was ordered to take a week's leave because he was getting on everybody's nerves. And we got very little leave because the job dictated what we needed to do.
But would you characterize your leadership then as pretty sound, huh?
Right. My commanding officer, Commander McDonald, had come up through the ranks in the Navy. In fact, he was an engineer on the USS Langley, which is our first aircraft carrier. And he had been retired as a lieutenant. And he was called back from retirement and then promoted to lieutenant commander. And then he was promoted to commander about a year before he was separated. But he was an excellent man to do business with. He was highly respected by everybody, and couldn't have asked for anybody better. In fact, when I got promoted to lieutenant senior grade, I think it pleased him more than it did me. Well, see, I was a lieutenant junior grade with responsibilities equal to a couple of lieutenant commanders, and I needed a little more rank. Anyway, he gave me his shoulder bars, but I consider that quite an honor.
I would say that would have been. Can you think of any particularly humorous or even sad incidents that you recall from your time in service that you can recollect?
Well, the work was very intense, but there was some social life. In Baltimore had a couple of officers' club where people came down and volunteered, and usually on a Saturday night I'd get down there for dancing, and there's some young ladies there. And occasionally they would have a buffet supper. Mm-hmm. Usually that was Sunday afternoon, though, and I got to only a few of those. My normal routine was Saturday to clean up, go downtown to the officers' club, and leave there about 11 o'clock, pick up a Sunday Baltimore Sun paper, get on the streetcar, and go home. More than once, I'd go about a mile past my stop, and that was the last streetcar, so I'd have to walk back. I'd be reading the paper, not paying attention to where I was. Eating was difficult there. I had to eat all my meals out. Another fellow and I rode the same. This fellow was Harry Kelly. He was stationed out of the yard, and he had graduated from Yale in 42, and he was a classmate of Henry Ford's second. They were in the same society, so he knew him quite well. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Harry and I would eat at the Bickfords, and we'd get in at the same time. We'd order the same thing every day, and the manager was named Hal Register for some reason. I still remember his name. Anyway, one day we missed our streetcar. The car was delayed or something, so we didn't have time for breakfast. The next morning we went in. Hal said, "Where were you? I had your food sitting up there, and you didn't come in."
Oh, man. Characterize your service for me, George. What do you think of what your time in service meant to you?
Well, I think it was a work that I enjoyed. It was a work that I thought at the time I was very well qualified for. I have always been above average in being conscientious about it. I want to put a little more into the job, and sometimes there was not enough of that done, particularly by the people who were actually doing the work. That upset me at times. But I think that the Navy got what they paid for me out of me. In fact, I remember writing home to my folks. I had made out my income tax one year, and I said, "I don't mind paying this money because the Navy is paying me, and if everybody's doing as much for what they're getting as I am, the government's getting a big bargain."
Great. How did it change your life, your service career, and maybe your outlook on life? If it did, I'm sure it had some effect.
Probably did. I realized I had lost 5.5 years of my working career, the best part of it. And ever since, I have tried to make that up, but you never can. So I think I've always been inclined to put more into a job than I might have otherwise, mm-hmm. to try to make up for lost time. I had made up my mind that I wouldn't get romantically involved because I didn't think that I was in position in the service to have a family. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get married until after I'd been out of the Navy about 5 years, and really had no, I dated a lot, but had no serious girlfriend mm-hmm. during that time.
Yeah. So how did your time in service change your life, actually? Did it change your life or your outlook, would you say?
I don't know consciously whether it did or not. I got a lot of broadening experience. I had led a fairly sheltered life mm-hmm. coming up. Didn't have a whole lot. I'd worked my way through Georgia Tech. And 25 cents at the move and a nickel for a cup of hot chocolate after was a big night out on a weekend. In the Navy, I got into a little more than that.
Right. Okay, anything else you want to add, George, before we conclude this?
I don't recall anything. You usually ask if anybody, what you got involved with the Red Cross. Well, I did. Our Navy group, civilians and military, were regular contributors to the blood bank in Baltimore. In fact, one day, I apparently almost passed out. People noticed I was turned white all of a sudden, and they ran over and grabbed me to keep me from falling over, but I didn't pass out. But that was a contribution.
Right. Everybody had to contribute something. Yeah. Some more than others. Okay, well, listen, thank you, George, for this afternoon together, and I appreciate your interview, and it's very interesting. Somebody who spent time in the U.S. for the most part, backing up the people who were overseas on the fighting lines.
I think that I feel that people tend to look down on us, but they're a whole lot of better off if they were in the service, because there were people like us looking after the interest in building
Absolutely.
Ships or planes or whatever, because
without the material you can't fight a war.
Yeah,
basically. Okay, thanks, George. Appreciate it.